In this special guest episode, we will learn how America's transportation infrastructure and systems have emerged and evolved from the very founding of our country to the present day. And let's find out how we can make America's transportation network better and more efficient than ever before. Stay tuned. Patriotism, faith, national unity, education, fiscal responsibility, civility, the values that define America. Fascinating stories and talks from America-loving patriots dedicated to preserving freedom, opportunity, and justice. Welcome to the Friends and Fellow Citizens Podcast. Welcome to another episode of Friends and Fellow Citizens. My name is Sherman Talosky, your host and creator of this podcast. Before we get started into another special guest episode, make sure that you subscribe and share this podcast with your friends and family. Today, we will be talking about America on the move. This is something that I think is just so fascinating when you especially look at the history of United States transportation and infrastructure. I think it's one of the most underrated aspects of American life and certainly shaped our country the way it is now. And I've got a special guest and great friend of mine who could be your next Secretary of Transportation in the future, Christian Pinheiro. Christian is one of my friends who is a fellow Bush School alumnus. He did the Master of Public Administration program. I did the Master of International Affairs program. But even though we were on two tracks, we really felt a connection between both of us, and we've become great friends since the beginning of our time at the Bush School. And he joins us with an exclusive interview talking about America's infrastructure and how we can be a part of a revolutionary era for America on the move. Christian, thank you so much for being on the show today. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you'd like to do in the future.
For sure. And you know, I want to start off, thank you so much, Sherman. I think this is a great launching platform for not only just young civic minds like ourselves as we walk into the career force, but anyone just interested in learning about different perspectives. And so it's always a great honor to be selected to kind of share those thoughts and get that conversation going. I definitely, you know, I was always interested in this field. Transportation is usually not one of the things people usually say that, you know, they're raised up and knowing that they want to do their entire lives. But I was fortunate to live most of my life in a military family. My dad serving 32 years in the United States Air Force. So I spent most of my childhood living overseas, predominantly in Germany and in Japan. So that's like the catalyst for my entire childhood experience. And throughout that, you know, I had the opportunity to really get a deep dive of how their transportation networks outside of the United States really function in terms of transit usability and just an efficient system that really can helps everyone kind of work in a cohesive unit. And then moving back into the States and going to college undergrad and then graduating from the Bush School, I was able to hone in on those skills because I knew that that was a field of interest and I couldn't at first really know where it could fit in a career setting. And so, you know, after doing a lot of research and getting my master's in public administration, I knew that the government public sector was for me. And becoming hopefully a liaison in the future for these issues as we move forward. Ideally, you know, I would love to work at a municipal transportation agency as a policy analyst. Policy field is where my niche is really at in the transportation scope. And then climbing my way up that ladder is where I would want to go. Eventually, hopefully, becoming a director for a transit agency or a Department of Transportation at the city level. But the ultimate goal would be actually to become the Secretary of Transportation in this United States. So wherever the path that takes me is all up for air. But you know, I've had a great following to kind of latch upon, and friends like just like yourself, Sherman, that really kind of propel me to aspire to seek those opportunities.
Well, I hope that a future president and a future Senate will consider you for a nomination position at the Department of Transportation, because I think you are absolutely amazing and incredible at talking about a subject that I think is very challenging to talk about, but something that is just so fundamentally important when it comes to talking about the future of the United States. Now, if I remember correctly, you worked for the Washington Metro. Is that correct?
No, for sure. It was actually the District Department of Transportation.
Ah, that's so right.
It was the Municipal Transportation Agency for D.C. We did a lot of work regarding WMATA, which is the Washington Area Metropolitan Transit Authority. But I was working specifically interning in the Policy and Legislative Affairs Division in the Office of the Director. So I was one of the lead interns helping policy proposals, writing up rulemakings and legislative remarks regarding transportation bills that affected the city, and working closely with a myriad of new age, new mobility, upcoming transportation projects, many of which I'll actually touch upon today in this podcast. And mostly just affecting just the DMV region as a whole, the DC, Maryland, Virginia kind of metroplex, and facilitating kind of how DC really wants to propel itself as a future transportation leader in the United States. And I had some fantastic opportunities. I did some research projects that I was able to actually present to the upper administrators, and the director was there too. And so I had a great team in the Policy and Legislative Affairs Division that really honed my passion for the transportation policy field. So it was a great experience, and I'm happy that we both had a chance to share what the DC life is. I live here. I'm native to this area. I moved here like around 8 years ago, but you know, it's always nice to have familiar faces around too.
That's incredible stuff, Christian. Congratulations on that. I think you did a great job. Let's dive right into it. Let's start from the early beginnings of America and the way people moved about during the early times when we had a few major cities just starting to build and starting to grow in size. Walk us through some of the phases of early transportation life of America.
For sure. And I think it's integral. A lot of people, it's one of those areas in the kind of lifestyle that people really overlook, the foundations of our cities, where they've gone in the past to where we are today, and how transportation has really coerced that development to work the way we have it working today. So there are generally four main eras that transportation has taken place since the founding of the country. It started actually as walking cities. The walking city era was the first kind of main development stepping stone. That was between like the mid 1700s to mid 1800s. So about a good 100-year chunk of establishing from closed grid city designs, predominantly in the eastern United States, in the Northeast, the New Yorks, the Philadelphias, the Bostons of the world. And if many of you know, who are familiar with U.S. history, those close kind of quarters that people used to work and live in. And those are the main hubs, central hubs for the time. When it comes to shipping goods, you know, those were the centers of merchants and economic stability. And so the places of opportunity, no different than what cities are today, and kind of in a different look. But specifically for the walking cities, you know, the cities then were designed for an average trip time between 20 to 25 minutes. So not very long. A lot of people lived where they worked. There were walking distance to the local central square, the church, the markets. Those were kind of the main symbols of these early American cities. And so the grid system of where people would transport with horse and carriages and were just walking with their families, they bisected those areas. So they would be designed relative to where people were. And so that was near the central business district. As cities developed more, you know, we think of the Industrial Revolution in the mid to late 1800s, early 1900s. We see this boom start facilitating faster. And so, not only does that mean more people, but that means more opportunities for people to also, live in, different areas than they couldn't have before. And so that led actually to the next phase, which is the horse-drawn era. So we're talking roughly around the same time, mid 1800s, 1850s to the 1880s. So, a more specific time period in the 19th century. But here we had the omnibus. So that was a combined horse-drawn streetcar combination. Some of them were pulled on rails. Some of them were just kind of strolled upon the street. But this was actually the first kind of collected mode that people could share ridership with. It was, you think of it as your pre-modern bus. You know, people were able to kind of share rides, 5 to 6 people at a time. And that really changed the fabric of where people were to work, where to live. Of course, you know, social constructs and gatherings were incentivized because of that as well. And because of the expanded distance that people could get from these new places, it really enabled the advent of the cable car to kind of come into fruition. So we kind of moved from using animal-based mobility systems to, once technology started to really get ramped up, we think of electrification, we get to cable cars, and then we get into the electric streetcar era. So that's the third phase, which was between 1880 and 1945. And that was a time where we really got to see the bulk of cities explode from the core central business district into what they call the starfish pattern. Many urban planners and kind of urban theorists would come categorize cities as a starfish. So basically that the routes for the streetcar lines would kind of move outward towards the center city and kind of create this star shape. And the ends of those star areas is where most of this new housing and urban development would really kind of rise. And, you know, these streetcars, it could go 15 miles an hour, which was, you know, very fast for that time. And the average person could not walk nearly that speed. And so you think of where people could commute from and build that way too. And then you get to, you know, these streetcars build up in size. You get streetcar suburbs. So then now people own houses along these streetcar lines that enable them to just live right off of the rail and go directly to work, depending on where that was. But it was a kind of a direct shot. You didn't have to take any more extended routes. And so then we move in, you know, we talk about how the advent of streetcars kind of shaped that. But then we move into what we are now in the modern era. We kind of push 40 years in the future in the 1950s. We get to the freeway era. And so I'll touch more about this in detail because I want to have a chance to for the discussion piece to take place. But, you know, that's when we really started to invest in highway development. And then we had the National Highway Defense Act of 1956 that President Eisenhower signed into law that really bolstered the current highway system we have today. And now we see cities just exploding. So in a good 150, 200 year time frame, give or take, we've really seen cities explode from just become, you know, 20 minute walking from one end to the other to, you know, at sometimes hours across.
Well, those four phases are certainly going to be crucial when we track kind of where America has been and where it could go. I mean, we're talking about future phases out there that we might not even know about as much, or perhaps phases that maybe are in existence today, but just haven't materialized the way that future generations will be able to see them. Just one quick point about the grid system, because I think that is something that's very clever from the city perspective. The grid system was especially good for America, which is a country built by immigrants. It was a lot easier for people, especially those whom couldn't speak English as a first language, to be able to navigate and to say, oh, I'm like to be at East 54th and 2nd Avenue or something. Just that easy for someone to be able to navigate But obviously, this wasn't just for the immigrant population. It was just for everybody. It's just convenient to get around with just a couple of numbers to know for different intersections and different addresses, wasn't it?
No, for sure. And I think, you know, when we talk about immigration, it's crucial in not only urban development, but because, you know, that also leads into how transportation systems are functioned. But, you know, we're human beings, right? We are social individuals. We are designed to have these kind of social connections and break these barriers. And so it makes complete sense. I wholeheartedly agree of the fact that grid cities were not just designed for directional purpose and make it easier for people to know where things are at. But I think psychologically, it's the most convenient way to kind of lay out how land use and urban space is really designed to be. And you know, in terms of trade, you know, you think of from the economics perspective too, grid systems are much easier from the downtown area to kind of flow up because you can already see the layout, you know where things are at. It's not like in modern day suburbs you see today where it's, you know, a highway that bisects into, you know, this other exit route that goes into another suburb. And so you're kind of lost and confused. And so I think a lot of inner city trade at the time, you know, in the early 1800s, when living far apart from each other wasn't necessarily the norm, allowed for those diverse groups to really kind of form and started the trend that we see with these ethnic enclaves, especially in the East Coast. They still exist in Baltimore, in New York, of course, you have the Chinatown, Little Italy. You know, those areas were formed because of the location of the streets. And I think has a great impact to how those are laid out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Let's talk about a few of the models that we can use to better understand how transportation and the movement of people and all that kind of relate to the shape of urbanization and the growth of suburbs and the development of urban America and rural America. The polycentric model comes to mind when I first think about this particular topic here.
You know, for sure. And so the polygraphic growth model, actually, it stemmed from an earlier model, was the Burgess model, actually was the first kind of urban land use model that was kind of put into practice by a sociologist actually named Ernest Burgess in 1925. And so he was a big philosophical, sociological thinker. He really liked the construct of how urban places were laid out and saw that as the launching point for not just social communication, but also, you know, day-to-day routines of how humans interact with other people around them. And so he actually created what is called the Burgess model, but also specifically the concentric circle model, which basically it takes cities and graphs them out into six concentric zones, essentially. And so we have the central loop, which is a CBD, which houses most of the downtown areas of today. You think of like tall skyscrapers for cities, you know, where all the businesses are held. The second zone for that is the factory zone. So that would be where most of the, at least in industrial America, where most of the factories would be built, constructed. Most of the workers would kind of facilitate the job sphere there. The third zone is a zone of transition. So that's kind of this median ground that kind of separates working class and upper working class. So, and I'll talk later, you know, this is, as you can see the trend, it starts to also relate to segregation and the division of ethnic communities and minorities and other groups. And then we get to the working class zone, which was the majority of the population who worked there. And then finally the last two, the residential and commuter zones were mostly for the wealthy. And I think it's an interesting dynamic because when you think of European cities, you see of Paris or Berlin or all these other kind of big metro areas in the European continent, it's kind of flipped. You know, the very wealthy or at least socioeconomic the higher status there are in the downtown areas, and then more of the lower class individuals are in the outskirts. And so it's actually a kind of an inverted model here in the United States where most of downtown is considered more of the working class live, and then up in the suburbs is where we have more of the upper class divisions. And so it's an interesting concept of how those two kind of realign. But that goes into the polycentric growth model, which you mentioned earlier, which is kind of what cities are deemed as today. So in Burgess's model, where you see that there is these kind of uniform circles that kind of encapsulate the city, polycentric growth model really talks about how there's multiple mini cores of each city. So there's really no longer one central business district. There's a multitude of different mini kind of exurb central business districts that kind of form into the same city. And so you see this in modern times, you see this in Houston, you see this in Metro Los Angeles, even in Metro New York, where you have the whole metro area is not just Manhattan, but now you have Newark, New Jersey, which is a downtown. You have, you go up north into Westchester County, and you have, you know, Yonkers, New York. And so you have these other growth areas that are their own communities in itself, but in the bigger picture are still part of the main city or the main urban area. And so when we talk of polycentric, you know, poly being multiple, that's what that model comes into be. And that was something that was really kind of founded based into the mid later, around the 1980s, 90s era, when we kind of really started thinking about cities in that regard. And now we think of, we're in 2020, and yeah, pretty much almost every city can be easily classified as some kind of polycentric model.
Well, thank you for that great answer, Christian. These models, I think, are going to be very important for us to look at the kind of the overlaps of different modes of transportation and big cities and rural communities, kind of how they all kind of intermingle and play a big role in the development of the nation. I remember reading about cars and learned about Henry Ford and all these great industrialists who really pioneered the car, but not just as a car as a mode of transportation, but really an American idea. It was competing against horse carriages and trolleys and all those other kinds of transportation. And I think the car, through lobbying efforts, through the geography of the country and additional support from perhaps those in government and in other business industries, the car really took off as that American way of life. And given how big this country is, there's certainly a huge need for us to be able to drive around and get to places where public transport cannot get us to a different part of the country. Even today, I feel the car is still symbolic of that American individualism aspect of this country, which I really like a lot. Kind of tying it a bit into what you were saying, Christian, which is about development of modern transportation systems and those eras you were talking about. And as cities grew, America started to grow and change.
Well, I think you hit it right on the head, you know, talking about how car-centric the United States is. It's definitely an anomaly when we think about other countries and around the world. This kind of, you know, we value personal freedom and, you know, patriotism to do, you know, what the individual instinct is. And so I think cars, at least the Henry Fords of the world, really capitalized on that piece, and that really helped them bolster that economics, but also redefined what cities were too. Robert Moses, because this actually does relate into how we kind of moved from cars into this multimodal change. Robert Moses was a prolific urban planner in the early 20th century. He did a lot of developing and planning work around the New York City area. And so he saw cities as quite the contrast of many urban planners and policymakers today would view them. He saw cities as ornate places to be built with towering bridges and elevated highways that could move people and whiz them back like really fast. And he had no regard of what actual urban space was. And so his models and his plans that he promoted to the city had highways bisecting communities. Some of the tourist ones, if you go to New York, the one that crosses over to the Bronx, the Cross Bronx Expressway, and then the Maj Deegan, those are two major ones that were instilled because of his vision to really just make cities all kind of car-centric and really disproportionately analyzed what other modes could be. So many transportation agencies, you know, as we go through the 1900s, really saw that as that's not what they really wanted to see. That's not a healthy city. You're going to have, you know, increased pollutants, increased congestion, and it's just not going to be what people want. You know, people want green serenity. They want their cities to be kind of this new hip way of what the environment surrounding them would be. You know, so green space and making sure that, you know, it's comfortable for everyone to use. So that really led into this whole multimodal movement, which predominantly didn't really actually start until the late 90s, early 2000s, when many transportation agencies got a hold of what this really was. You know, and we moved into this idea of this transit oriented development. So this is a planning and development method that really combines city revitalization, suburban renewal, walkable neighborhoods, and forms it into a single, accessible, and economically viable area. So modern day gentrification, nonetheless. But, you know, in its early stages, it really catapulted how cities were thought of to be these areas of just getting from point A to point B, when we really needed to go back and understand how can we make cities work for everyone? Because not everyone has a car. Not everyone wants to have a car. And making cities designed by personal choice is really what the main goal is. And we have a long ways to go. Actually, the American Society of Civil Engineers has deemed our road system as a D+, which out of the rankings that we know of is extraordinarily low. So we're not anywhere close in terms of our road conditions now at the pace we want to be. And a lot of that stems from the scars from the Robert Moseses of the world, who really promoted these double-decker highway systems. And so now, you know, we think of 50, 60 years later, we become kind of the fall people to really like eliminate past projects where were horrible, and kind of start from the bottom up. So the whole Burgess model, going back to that, you know, how the city center is kind of the cohesive unit, that's where we should be going today and what agencies should be looking towards. You know, we should get away from incentivizing automobiles and going into more transit hubs, walking and biking, taking buses and rapid transit in that way, and really incentivize funding dollars to go in that direction.
Well, with that disappointing D+, America definitely has to start studying how we're going to get our infrastructure up to an A level, because that's exactly what we need right now. We need both sides to come together and figure out what's going on and to think about how we're going to proceed and ensure that we can retain an A level infrastructure system. And as we approach the 30-minute mark, we are going to take a quick 20-second break. You can pause this episode and take as long of a break as you like. We'll come back very shortly, right after this. Welcome back. We are now in our second segment of this episode, talking about America on the Move and U.S. transportation systems. Christian, let's build upon a little bit more on the first part here. The first part, we talked about the history. We talked a little bit about the troubling signs that we're seeing as we kind of see with the highways and all that. Before the episode, before our show today, we were going through some of the issues with infrastructure in America. There's one particular issue I want to really bring up, because this is something that you brought up I thought was so important, and that is on transportation funding. It seems like Democrats and Republicans agree that we need more funding for infrastructure, because infrastructure has so many third-party benefactors when it comes to the construction of a road or the construction of a new cell tower, a new bridge, etc. But there is a lot of debate on the funding aspect, because multiple people disagree on how people are going to have fun for this. I mean, money doesn't grow on trees, so you need to figure out some way to be able to get the cash. At the same time, you cannot just print money out and pay for your roads and all that. That's just not a sustainable solution, is it? So, Christian, what is the nature of this debate on transportation funding?
How we have funded transportation is and has been and continues to be an ongoing conversation on many ends of the political spectrum, Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians. And what's so fascinating for me and why I love this field so much is that it is not a Republican or Democrat issue. I mean, everyone wants to have roads to drive on. They want to have cities that work collectively for everyone. And so it's not a real hot button issue that you would think would stir a lot of controversy. But when it, you know, when money talks and money becomes the conversation starter, I'm a big believer that projects should be done as safely and efficiently as possible, using as little taxpayer money as we can. Although, I mean, from a larger extent, most of transportation funding projects do come from user taxes and whatnot. And I think that's a direction we need to really actually stir back into while it opens a bunch of can of worms for a lot of people who are like, you know, want to keep money for themselves and the money that they've earned, you know, should go directly to what they deem as fit. We live in a society that really needs to understand that transportation is a shared use and it requires everyone's efforts to really be pushed into that. So when we think of funding, historically, transportation, at least at USDOT, is supplied by the Highway Trust Fund. So it's a massive bill of funding area that separates highway and massive transit programs through state and federal grants, and also goes into local municipalities as well. But at least in this fiscal year, the Highway Trust Fund is set to have $43 billion in its bubble. $25.8 billion of that would be for excise tax on gasoline and diesel fuel. And I'll talk about the gas tax later and what that has done in the shaping of funding. And then, of course, the other 84% of the total are accounts that come from sales tax, heavy trucks, other kind of municipal levies that the federal government doesn't really have control over. It's more of a state-run, local-run incentive. But there are a variety of other ways. Public-private partnerships are crucial, in my opinion, for transportation and how we can reallocate funds. And I think the private sector and public sector, they both bring value in terms of not just funds and feasibility of cash, but also they're two kind of separate areas that can work together to extrapolate on problems that both sides, you know, feel is crucial. Public dollars want to go to investing in back into the community, where private dollars want to see those benefits reap so they can have increased foot traffic for businesses and retail and things that promote economic stability, which are also equally as important. With that, we also have federal loans. So we have the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, or the TIFIA. So that's a program that was established in the early 2000s that is a way that states can ask for grant money from USDOT, whether that's FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, Federal Highway Administration, the Federal Railroad Administration. So these bureaucratic entities within DOT that can administer funds for those specific areas. And then we also go into, you know, these congressionally approved bills. The most recent one actually was the Fixing America Surface Transportation Act, or the FAST Act. So that was initiated under Obama's administration, under the purview of Secretary Anthony Fox. And he really bolstered this idea that we need to have a five-year-long bill that really implements big-picture surface transportation investments. So increasing state and local safer funding opportunities and having those clear guidances. Unfortunately, because it's 5 years, most of these bills, you know, at least the FAST Act, that was $305 billion for 5 years. So as you can tell, transportation, unfortunately, is not the cheapest area for the federal government to really afford sometimes. But so 2020, this year is actually the first year that we'll have to establish a new congressionally approved bill. And one is already in the process. It's being under legislative review right now. It's called the Invest Act. So it's the Investing for New investing in a new vision for the environment and surface transportation in America, and also provides $411 billion for the Highway Trust Fund. So this would be great news for a 30% increase for road safety, 60% increase for bikes and pedestrians. And then actually also requests that states focus more on maintenance before actually starting new projects, which is a great incentive too, because we have tons of bridges and tons of roads that need repair before we actually start funding new ones. And then in other taxes as well, we have the gas tax, which is probably the largest controversy of all the of different ways of paying for roads. It hasn't been changed since 1993. So, you know, basic economics states that money worth 20, 30 years ago is not worth the same today. So it's still been set at 18.4 cents per gallon. And that's, of course, based on 1993 standards. So we're in 2020. And so that actual has not been changed since then, which is problematic because, you know, as economics shift and, you know, money kind of changes form throughout time, we really need to see an increase in the gas tax that really equals to what the current state of the United States is today. There are other alternatives that many congressmen and politicians from both the Democrats and the Republicans are really kind of dishing out. One is a vehicle's mile travel tax, which would be a policy change on motorists based on how many miles they've traveled. It would actually spur a lot of new ways of funding because some people may drive less than others, especially in urban areas where they'll take another form of transportation. The downside to that, of course, is privacy and security. And a lot of people, a lot of conservatives feel that you know, it's against the Privacy Act. We're having information from databases that we don't know where they're going to. And that stems another controversy as well. And then finally, we have the newest form, I guess, the kind of the highlight of everything else. We have congestion pricing. So that's kind of this new topic that many cities are going through now, which would be taxing drivers riding into a certain area of a downtown. So in London, it's already been done. It was passed in 2003. They have a cordon pricing tax where drivers are charged around, I think, $18 or $19, whatever the conversion is for pounds for each time they go into this kind of cordon pricing zone. And those funds are directly mandated to go into public transportation. So it's another way to funnel money into alternative modes. As you can see, that already stems a lot of different kind of conversations about people wanting – they're already taxed a lot. Already, do they want to be taxed more for an additional fee? How would that impact congestion in reality? And so there's no city in the United States has actually implemented a congestion pricing or congestion charging fee yet. New York City is the only one that's promoted the idea, and they've set off a plan to kind of implement a pilot phase in 2021. So there's all kinds of emerging ways of how we can really envision where funding and dollars go. But, you know, it's up to the politicians because at the end of the day, it's all what the public really deems is best for their communities.
That's a great answer. Really thoughtful, very well put together. I think it'll be interesting to track some of these legislative debates on how funding should be created for transportation purposes. I think these debates are certainly going to keep going on and on. There's been a bit of debate recently in New York. I believe that they are going to impose some kind of a congestion charge there. And I think one of the things to look at is to look at international models. For example, let's look at what's happening in London with the congestion charge. Now, during this COVID pandemic, the charges have largely been suspended, especially for essential workers. Even though I've seen that there is data showing that with a congestion charge, you're seeing approximately a 10% decrease in traffic volume. However, there are a number of factors to consider when a particular municipality is upgrading the infrastructure, particularly on construction zones and new bike lanes, as well as a change in tastes and preferences on transportation usage. The London congestion charge was introduced in 2003 and imposes currently a £15 charge on most vehicles from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. more on these topics at a later time. I just want to get a bit of an overview in this episode today to kind of outline kind of where we could go with a lot of these debates about transportation funding. I mentioned about COVID with regards to the congestion charge that's currently suspended for an indefinite period of time. Speaking of COVID, I think we need to look at how important the transportation industry sustainability during a very pressing and uncertain time. Christian, walk us through some of the COVID-19 challenges that the U.S. transportation system has had to deal with over these last few months and some issues that they will continue to deal with over the next few months and perhaps next several years.
Well, first, I'm really happy that you brought this up because, of course, you know, when we think of current trends affecting the country, you know, the coronavirus has really put a shamble on a lot of areas for this country. And I'd be remiss to not start off by saying a huge thanks to everyone in the transportation field, the bus drivers, the metro riders, the airline pilots, and the flight attendants. They are doing their job and they still have to rattle with the, you know, the risks that are associated with a transportation network that doesn't really allow people to be, you know, socially distant sometimes. So they do a lot of great work. You know, I hope that they're all doing well as we talk about in this topic. But in terms of the impacts, it's been a struggle. I know from what I've known, from what other cities are experiencing outside of DC. There was actually an article I read that stated if the downward trend continues that we're at with the number of deaths we have, transit agencies can see a loss between $29 to $40 billion next year, which, as you mentioned, Sherman, I mean, we're already talking about, you know, D+ ratings with transportation and how our country currently functions. And so a loss of billions of dollars is definitely moving in the wrong direction. So, you know, in agencies like the New York MTA, WMATA, luckily they've received funding from President Trump's administration from the CARES Act. About $25 billion was received from USDOT to go directly to public transit funding. But of course, with those numbers that the transit center states that the statistics are going to be, you know, we're still going to be far behind what we really need. What I fear the most are the local areas, you know, the cities that rely on their own inner city transportation agencies like King County Metro in Seattle. They've seen a decline of 60% in their ridership. The New York MTA has seen a decline at 87%. And then San Francisco's Bay Area Rapid Transit has seen a 92% decrease. So we're almost reaching capacity where there's almost no one who wants to ride on public transit because of the concerns of the coronavirus. And of course, you know, I'm always a huge advocate. Health and safety are imminent. And I know transportation agencies, that's their number one goal, is to make sure people are safe. But at the end of the day, when we think long term, you know, eventually when this pans out, you know, God willing, there's no more deaths to the extreme amount we have now, and people go back into being constructive people in their careers and going into cities and traveling again, you know, we need to make sure that there's adequate funding that could stabilize these agencies. So many cities have actually moved to this open streets policy, healthy communities. They're really trying to revitalize and incentivize biking and walking and building cities and advertising cities to be more open for people to not even use vehicles anymore. And so that limit, of course, you know, increases social distancing. It's a little bit more ease on the anxiety levels for people who are, you know, already concerned of how to get around. And I think DC has been a staunch proponent and a leader in this. The District Department of Transportation has laid out several municipal response plans already in lieu of the COVID events that have taken place. Those include car-free lanes. So DC already has 3 quick build bus priority pilot projects set up. In the city, there's one on 7th Street Northwest, Martin Luther King Jr. Southeast, and M Street in Southeast. And so these major corridors are going to be car-free, which will allow people on bikes and transit and walking to have ample space for them, so we don't have to worry about people being in close quarters with anyone. Slow Streets is another big initiative. Mayor Bowser in D.C. This past June announced that There are going to be 7 total locations for slow street initiatives. This will give residents more space to social distance while moving around, and give adequate space for even restaurants, as we think about that too. Another one is sidewalk extensions. So this goes into this complete streets mentality, which is another transportation model that uses road space to fulfill more than just cars. It refers to bike lanes. It's extended sidewalks for people to have, you know, dining facilities, restaurants outside. And in COVID, in this time of takeout delivery, or, you know, just kind of not eating inside the building, those have become the biggest, kind of a new wave of how do we use our urban space. And this allows, of course, restaurants to have their social distancing measures. And then again, we have, which I'll talk to next about TNCs or transportation network companies, but most of them have also have agreements with the cities like DC to have shared mobility for essential workers. This means free or discounted services for EMT, medical, law enforcement personnel, those who are risking and putting their lives on the line in wake of this pandemic, to kind of also ease that internal stress. So there are municipal strategies. I wish there was a kind of a one size fits all when we think of national perspectives. But I think this is baby steps. And I think that cities and mayors and local leaders, and first off, vote for your local leaders too. I think people forget that that's equally as important. They can set the stage for state laws that will eventually come into federal law. So I think if more cities start to adopt these kind of urban tactical urbanism mentality, eventually the federal government will try to start incorporating that into legislation as well.
Very well said. Very well said, Christian. I want to join you in our appreciation and thanks to the transportation workers out there who are still maintaining our transportation network and keeping America moving, despite the low ridership levels, despite the new requirements, the new safety requirements that they have to cope with and comply with, despite the difficult circumstances and the different conditions, they are still out there working for all of us. So a big thank you to those working in the transportation industry and for what they do every single day for the American people. Another thing I wanted to add is that the COVID-19 is really going to be changing the way we look at prioritizing transportation of different sectors of the economy. You know, that nowadays there's companies like Google and Twitter that have been talking about keeping the work at home policies until the summer 2021. You know, what does that mean for the day-to-day commuters that we all know? And we know that they're going to come back. We know they are going to come back. However, the extent in which that is going to happen and the extent in which the commuters are still going to be out there riding transportation systems the same way before the pandemic is really up for question. And I think we really need to keep that in mind for sure. As local leaders, as lawmakers debate on what transportation is going to look like as we move through the pandemic. And now it's time to take our second and final 20-second break before we cut into our third and final segment of this episode. In the next segment, we're going to be talking about modern technologies that we are exploring as a country to keep America on the move for more years to come and for generations to come. We'll be right back after this short break. And now we are in our final segment for this episode on America on the Move, American Transportation and Systems. Christian, now that we're in the phase of modern technologies and all that, you mentioned before the episode, we were talking about this topic and this episode. You've mentioned TNCs a little bit before, but I want to get into the TNCs and the LMDs now. how have they shaped America in terms of where we could be going in terms of transportation technology and the way forward on transportation practices?
No, yeah, for sure. It's definitely a more recent topic. Transportation network companies and personal mobility devices have never been in conversation until probably the past 5-6 years at most. And so many cities are having to struggle to kind of really adapt to technology. And I think, you know, we're fortunate to live in a society that really promotes innovation, and cities are really opening up to data sharing and all these other methods that can really launch transportation to the next level. I don't know if we're ever going to get to flying cars and hoverboards that Marty McFly uses, but we have our own way of administering technology here that I think it's definitely possible in the long run. But in terms of transportation network companies, you know, those are the Ubers, the Lyfts of the world, has really changed the fabric of how people get around. Before, you know, we would just hail a cab. You know, we would have to go through the process of finding which cab company was the most reputable, which service they had, do they even go across the city limits? And, you know, since the advent of these smartphone apps that now allow anyone to download, you know, an app that tells, hey, how far these cars are at, when they can pick me up, and then automatically have the transfer fee already inside the device, has revolutionized how people get around. It has its drawbacks, of course. That I think the benefit of it is that it has allowed choice. This my own personal mantra of like personal choice for transportation and evolving cities and our networks to work around people for their best interest. At the same time, I also think it's also oversaturating some of the markets we have. You know, when we think of going back to cities that rely on sustainable transportation and environmentalism and less pollutants, unfortunately, Ubers and Lyft, those companies don't really detract from that. They, if anything, they add to the congestion because it's more cars that are unlicensed, most likely. No, at one given time, no one can really estimate how many there's going to be in a given area. So that can really increase, we think of like health concerns for inner city individuals. When we think of PMDs, that's even more modern than it is Uber and Lyft. These are the scooter sharing, the e-bikes, these kind of dockless mobility that we see in cities, which is also kind of just it wasn't here 1 year, and then another year they were just all dumped all over the place. And even in A&M, when we went to Texas A&M, you know, they had a deal with VeoRide and Ofo, which were their first e-scooters or dockless scooter companies. And I definitely was an avid user of them. But as far as you know, I'm sure you there are tons of other times where you also were like, this is just too much.
Couldn't agree more.
It's kind of sad. But I think it also, you know, it's good because I feel like in college campuses, they're great for other ways of moving around. But, you know, when we think of this idea that private transportation firms are, you know, they're most likely reluctant to give away crucial information like shared data or user-based information. So, you know, the public sector has, you know, they struggle with, you know, how do we keep them in check? How do we make sure that, you know, these systems are being followed? In my opinion, I think many cities are still struggling of how to even tackle the dockless scooter piece. You know, I think we really need to start in, having these public outreach programs about how to ride a bike safely in downtown, you know, using the bike lanes, not using the sidewalk. There's these kind of rules of engagement that come with that. And I think a lot of that is missing. And so interning at DDOT, you know, we did a lot of extensive work with making sure the public was aware, because that's crucial. The public does not know how to use a certain device, especially an up and coming transportation mode like you know, bird scooters or those other devices. Your cities are in for a long run of permits that are going to expire and people not abiding by those ways. And so you know, those are just an added market to that field. And you know, I think it's only going to evolve. DC, I use DC as an example for everything. It's it's what I'm comfortable using, but I know other cities also use SDOT for Seattle, uses it too. But these areas that really try to incentivize the public learning field and the education field.
Excellent response, Christian. Now, what about bus rapid transit?
Well, I love the concept of BRT, bus rapid transit. Many cities are reaching new heights when it comes to investing properly in public transportation, which, you know, especially in disenfranchised communities that don't necessarily have ever had those systems in place. But bus rapid transit is essentially, it's a high quality bus-based transit system. It delivers fast, comfortable, and cost-effective services at city level. So it dedicates certain lanes for buses only, whether that's improved stations, easy boarding on and off processes. The technology in it can allow customers to pay, to pre-board and pay before they even get on the bus. So to ease the efficiency for the next round of buses that are supposed to come, I believe it's every 3 minutes or so. Some cities have shorter or longer time frames. But cities like New York, they've had Mayor de Blasio and Commissioner Polly Trottenberg at NYC DOT have laid out a great plan for their Better Buses Initiative program, which lays out a multitude of different bus rapid transit projects they want to get installed in all of the boroughs. Most notably, the 14th Street Busway, which is going to be the first of its kind arterial road dedicated only to buses. So this will allow drivers to, they will not be able to make any right-hand turns to exit onto those streets to ease the capacity for the bus flow to be succinct and on time and on schedule. But it goes back into this idea of sharing the road. And I think a lot of people still need to adapt that the road is for, you know, buses can carry twice as many people as multiple cars can. And so they should carry more leverage when it comes to making sure that they're on time. Other cities, DC, of course, has the 16th Street Bus Priority Project, which is underway. I think it started this past summer. The K Street Transitway is another big one that's going to be a cross-functional bus rapid transit facility for a counterflow bus path, which will enable both buses to kind of go north and south at the same time. So these are technologies that are allowing what was once adequate and antiquated public transportation projects into really investing in the efficiency and reliability and the credibility that these city transportation agencies really need.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of in carpool lanes and how we prioritize carpool lanes to prioritize people giving others a ride, just like how we're prioritizing buses and prioritizing roads for buses, which I think will be very interesting to track as we move along and see the effects of this bus rapid transit program. Before we get to our reflection part of the episode, let's talk about something that still blows my mind, and I'm sure a lot of people's minds, which is AI technology. AI is still a new concept in American infrastructure and technology. We have seen some tests from Tesla and others on self-driving cars, for example. Pretty mind-boggling, I gotta say. I don't know what the future is really going to be like with self-driving cars, but I'm hoping that they drive better than human beings, for sure.
So, you know, that's another hot-button question in the transportation field. I guess the short answer is we don't know. I think technology is evolving so much faster than we can even comprehend it to be, that there's, you know, we think that we're going to meet these milestones and then something happens that completely takes it off the hook, or, you know, we find ourselves not really in where we want to be. But, you know, it's so fascinating to understand. I mean, even in the beginning of our conversation, when we were talking about the foundations of cities and walking and horse carriages, and now we're talking about driving in self-automated, you know, several ton, you know, capsules that can just whiz people around. I think it's just phenomenal how far we've come in society and the innovation that we bring. To a degree, we have self-driving cars. I mean, I think everyone's familiar with Tesla and their self-parking features, their self-automated driving features to some degree. But when I think about AI technology, I really have to think of what level are we at? And transportation agencies determine this by this scale model that is basically, there's five key levels of automation that we have to think about. 0 to 2 is basically no automation to partial automation. Where we stand now, we straddle really kind of between the two and three, three being conditional automation. So that means the execution of steering and acceleration is all done by the computer system. The monitoring and the driving is done by the computer system, but the fallback remains the human driver. And I think we'll be in that phase for quite some time, just given the amount of, you know, ethics evolved around how safe people feel about relying on technology for them to safely get to their destination. And I think it's been hard hit, you know, when we think about while successes have been made already in terms of innovation. You know, we had the crash in Arizona where one of the Tesla automated projects ended up killing an elderly woman on the street crossing the road. And then we think of even in prior administrations, in Obama's administration, we had the Takata malfunctions for the airbags for the Toyota cars. So, you know, when we think about self-automation, it goes beyond just I can hop in a car and just take me anywhere. We have to think of the safety mechanisms that each car has to be designed for, because any of those, one, is a liability, and two, we don't want anyone to risk their lives going into a vehicle. At the end of the day, you know, we want to strive that excellence is key, and that if it takes a few more years, a few extra decades to get it right, that's where I kind of see it. And some sources say we may be in that sphere by the mid-2020s. I personally disagree, just based on a safety component on that. I don't probably see this going into fruition from, you know, market sale probably until the mid-century. You know, we're thinking 2040s, 2050s in my book. But I think, you know, it stems off from what I said earlier is that no one really knows the timeline. But until we have regulations in place of how AI technology is used and how these companies want to work with public sector, I think would really shape how we have the discussion moving forward.
Absolutely. And as excited as I am about modern technology and as excited as other people are, we still need to consider public safety, right? I think it's particularly troubling when we have certain people who say that, well, technology is the new normal and we have to accept it. Well, people accept things differently than others. And no one individual can control and determine what someone accepts or how they accept or when they accept it. But the point is that technology does need to kind of settle down in society a little bit. And there are, of course, political consequences of that when lawmakers are considering rolling out AI technology, because there are certain factors that come into play, the legal aspect, the public safety aspect, national security aspect, all these kind of factors coming together. We really hope that we can find some good solutions and come up with ways that foster that innovation so that we get that great technology, but we also make sure that we are keeping people safe. And it's that balance that lawmakers and leaders and people have to walk.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an evolving kind of the discipline in transportation, right? I mean, I think, you know, we've all seen the Back to the Futures of the world, right? With Marty McFly on the hoverboard and the Doc Brown in his, you know, flying car, you know. And as we grow up as kids, we always see that as something that's pretty possible in you know, in modern times now. I think now, granted, with the technology, it's definitely something to weigh in the how effective can it be? And, you know, from a transportation perspective, especially in the discipline and many municipal agencies, is safety is number one priority. So, you know, how do we make sure that, you know, the technology that we have that is currently being tested is 100% safe for people to use? A lot of researchers and kind of theorists in this field have mixed reviews about when we may see this in the rising. We all know about Tesla. That's kind of the most notorious form of AI technology that is present now. But many theorists, you know, some people say that we won't have it into another, you know, until the half of the century, until 2050. Others might say, you know, as soon as 2025, 2030. And it all depends, I think, on how fast technology can evolve, because if we know anything, each year is a new thing. You know, I think no one can really predict how fast innovation can really, you know, make a difference into this. I will say, though, you know, that there's several, of course, you know, positives and negatives when it comes to to innovation and AI technology. Of course, one is revolutionizing how we travel. You know, we can improve travel times, eliminate traffic and congestion, even signal timing with calculated signal to car frequencies that can allow vehicles to talk to traffic signals and roadway signs to make an efficient road network, you know, and decrease congestion in some of our highly urban areas. But at the same time, you know, with of course the safety piece as a heavy thing to think about, we also have to weigh in the complications of data sharing. And we mentioned that earlier. But this area, and especially in a field you may know more than I do, national security and the intelligence field, you know, how far can we go that won't allow cars to be hackable? From a public safety and national homeland security piece, you know, how do we make sure that people can adequately access their vehicles and not worry about data being tracked or personal information to be encrypted? So those are kind of the other things we have to really think about when we talk about self-driving vehicles.
Well, I appreciate that answer, Christian. I will say that it is of utmost importance to consider these cyber side effects of AI technology and the public safety, national security risks that they have on our nation. Certainly something to look at, and I'm quite confident that this is going to be a major issue as we progress through the decades to the middle of the 21st century and beyond. So now I want to move on to our final part of this episode, which is what I call the reflection episode, where we think about the principles of this podcast and think about how we can apply them in our daily lives and things that we can advocate for as citizens of the United States and of other countries as well. So the title Friends and Fellow Citizens comes from the first few words of President Washington's farewell address in 1796. And we can talk about Washington's principles in all of our podcast episodes. We talk about patriotism, faith, national unity, civility, education, and fiscal responsibility. What principles, Christian, do you believe are especially relevant in our conversation today about America on the move and American transportation systems and infrastructure?
I definitely agree of all those principles, although to me, as someone who's a staunch supporter of public outreach programs and incentivizing and bringing civic awareness to the public, education is crucial. And, you know, I think it speaks volumes today when we think about the implications of moving from, even AI technology or even beyond that, just the ideas of how do we reshape our cities into designing them to be sustainable and equitable and environmentally, enriching. You know, having the public gain the knowledge and the education on what those aspects are, and becoming more mindful of the policy implications, not only in the national level, but in their own states and localities, and it plays is a crucial part, especially when we think of, you know, transportation planning, plans that are administered at the state level. We think of metropolitan planning organizations that play a crucial role for metro regions in deciphering, you know, the next 10, 20, 30 years of how transportation can affect their communities. Those are all integral in making sure that the public is aware that, these things can be, they're challenging, of course, but they're also possible with positive reinforcement, public education, and just making sure that everyone is on the same page.
I agree with that wholeheartedly, Christian. Education really is so fundamental, and I think it starts from home. You know, learning about what these transportation systems do and how they affect our communities, I think, is absolutely critical. One other principle I want to add on to this is fiscal responsibility. We're talking about big projects here, from AI to bridges to trains to airports and cyber, you name it. All this has a price tag, and I think we need to just remind ourselves that what we spend on is not just on ourselves. It's also about future generations who are going to use them. So part of it is knowing how to spend and where to spend it on. But I think the other aspect is knowing the cost and understanding that we might not be paying for everything that we spend on. If future generations pick up the bill, we need to be absolutely clear that what we're spending on and what we're asking future generations to spend on is worth the time, the energy, the effort, and the willpower. Before I ask you about your favorite founding father, which is a unique aspect of this podcast and one that I always ask to my guests on this show, I want to highlight someone whom I think is someone worth remembering and looking at. A guy who might not get as much attention as he probably deserves, in my opinion, but I'm talking about New York Governor DeWitt Clinton. DeWitt Clinton served about 8 to 9 years as New York governor. He was also a senator from New York and mayor of New York City. So he was all New York politics. Probably not an easy job then, probably not an easy thing to handle in this day and age. And what I like about DeWitt Clinton is that he was New York governor at the time when the Erie Canal was constructed. And the Erie Canal, of course, runs through New York State all the way up to Buffalo. And it just made commerce a lot easier. In fact, some prices, I believe, fell something along the lines of 90% or something, just cut costs so dramatically. So great for business, great for consumers as well. And Governor Clinton always believed that infrastructure is how we build America and how we move forward. It's obviously not the only thing that moves America forward, but it is a very, very critical thing that we need to look at. I absolutely agree with Governor Clinton when he says that infrastructure is what gets America to participate in the political process, to help Americans out of poverty, and to drive the economy. So a little tribute to a governor whom I hope will get more recognition in the future. So now, this is the final question of our episode today. Christian, who is your favorite founding father and why?
Well, first of all, I think that was a great kind of exit card with the DeWitt Clinton. I think it's always great to have a touch with U.S. history and connecting it to these major topics. And I think that was really good. For me, you know, I'm a staunch supporter of these American ideals that our founding fathers have set up. One that really does stick out the most to me would probably be Benjamin Franklin. And I have to give my dad a shout out on this one because he raised me and my brothers and our whole family unit essentially with this mantra of don't count time, make time count. So that's really kind of been ingrained with, not only how I live my life, but how, I've kind of followed my father's footsteps in that realm. And I think, you know, Benjamin Franklin speaks clearly to that. You know, he was someone who definitely did not count time. You know, he made every single moment of his life an impactful one, whether it was, you know, becoming the first U.S. ambassador to France, you know, kind of setting the stage for getting French allegiance when we needed it most in terms of international aid. He made astounding scientific developments in demography, which really tie into my love for transportation and talking about population density and the role that demographics play in terms of societal ways, and even the fact that he went by the rules of his daily schedule, set it out perfectly, waking up at 5, going to bed at 10, and maximizing his time. And there's not a lot of people, I think, back in that, at least in the Founding Fathers era, with an exception of probably Thomas Jefferson, that were really kind of these Renaissance men. You know, they kind of implored, they were inquisitive, they embraced knowledge and learning. And for me, not just from a personal note, but, those are qualities that I try to surround myself with individuals such as yourself and most people that I've had the opportunity to kind of work with and share knowledge with. Franklin really kind of, I feel like embodies that for a lot of people.
Well, that's an excellent choice, Christian. Ben Franklin truly is an American hero. I certainly would be one to try to not let him down, but he seems like a man with high expectations. Certainly had high expectations for himself.
Looking down upon a lot of us who feel like we waste time doing nothing. So,
but I just want to thank Christian today for being such a great guest. I mean, you've spent almost 75 minutes talking about some really interesting topics here, from the origins of America's cities to new infrastructure and transportation systems that still run today, like bus rapid transit, to AI technology and where we might go in the future. There is no question that the future is uncertain. However, I think with the kind of leadership and the kind of expertise that Christian is showing to myself and to this country, I'm in no doubt that future leaders will take our technology and our transportation to the future for good purposes and for great prosperity and freedom in our country.
Well, I just want to say thank you, Sherman, for this amazing opportunity. You know, as I touched on in the beginning when we started, you know, I think it's always great to have these conversations to really learn from each other. And that's what this is all about. You know, I continue to learn, you know, from mentors and colleagues such as yourself. And I think it's useful to kind of share my thoughts and how I feel, you know, impacting the transportation field, which is an area that I love so much, and I could not see myself doing, studying, and being a part of anything else. So a huge thank you to you. And I look forward to, you know, hearing what other guests you have on this podcast, because I think this is a great launching point for you. And I know you're going places as well, and we'll definitely keep in touch. So thank you for everything.
Those are such kind words, Christian. I really appreciate it. It means so much to me. And I want to thank you for all of your efforts and for being on this great podcast episode. And with that, we will wrap up our episode today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Be sure to subscribe and share this podcast with your friends and family. And I hope you have a great rest of your day and rest of your week. I'll see you next week at the next episode of Friends and Fellow Citizens. See you next time. Goodbye.